Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
Congressman Thomas Massie joining me on the Disruption Zone. This is part three of our multi-part series on the D.C. swamp. And welcome back to the program, sir. These are always a big hit with our listeners. Thanks for coming on again.
Hey, thanks for having me, Leland. This is one of my most favorite topics.
We're going to talk about the swamp when it refers to farm freedom, which I think in light of the COVID-19 outbreak is probably more important than ever, as for whatever reason, people are hoarding things that they don't need to be hoarding, and it's causing temporary supply shortages in stores. And fresh meat is something a lot of people would like to be able to get their hands on. And if we could remove some of the regulations, letting farmers, local farmers, get that food to people that need it, it would probably be a better world, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And we could be in for some long-term shortages. You know, if GDP goes down by 10%, what happens to food production? If it right. Does it go down by 10%? And now the government's talking about paying people to stay home instead of coming to work, i.e., you know, extended unemployment claims and sick leave. And I've got a local seed store, farm store, and the guy's telling me, hey, I got to get the seeds out. I got to get the fertilizer out. These farmers aren't going to be able to plant their fields, and this will have a ripple effect.
Right.
So having a local food supply, is more important than ever now. And knowing where your meat came from might be a good idea, since they got rid of country of origin labeling in the swamp.
Right.
They did that on beef and pork in, I think, 2015. So, yeah, this is a timely topic. In other words, direct-to-consumer, food freedom, farm freedom, having the ability to sell food directly off the farm to a local community and getting the government the hell out of the way.
Yeah, well, and right now the government seems to be doing more harm than good. I'm supportive of this idea of maybe taking 2 weeks to take a breath for society to kind of calm down from buying all the toilet paper. I see the value in social distancing to stop the spread of a virus like this. However, the problem that I'm seeing, Congressman Massie, is that I don't see anyone in the government talking about an end game, a strategy, benchmarks for success. You know, 2 weeks America can handle a two-week pause and reset, and I think there would even be some silver linings in that. Beyond that, though, small businesses being halted for a month, for 6 weeks, for 2 months. This is devastating to small organizations that operate on small profit margins. The restaurant thing really kind of irked me because, you know, you could ask restaurants to maybe say, limit your capacity and then spread that capacity out so that people are farther away from each other. You know, don't sit anyone booth to booth and table to table. Those would have been better solutions for restaurants to keep them open. Restaurants run on a famously very tiny profit margin. I'm telling you right now, a lot of our favorite places that we like, when this is over, they're not going to be there anymore.
And look, here's something they could have done at restaurants. They could do what Dollar General stores are doing, which is the first hour of shopping is reserved for seniors. Okay, so when the restaurant, let's say they open up at noon, basically they only serve seniors until, let's say, 2 o'clock.
Right.
Or maybe they serve them until 5. I know a lot of seniors that eat their supper at about 5 o'clock.
Yeah, right? Go on a cruise and you'll see how early elderly people want to get to the buffet. Just let them in there first.
And I love that. When my kids get off the bus, my wife's parents are ready to feed them dinner.
Right now.
Yeah, right now. So so that works pretty well, but they could have done sensible things like that, like segmenting the population and serving the elderly first, who are far more at risk from this virus than the young folks are. Or like you said, you could have seating that's further apart, et cetera, et cetera. But instead, they've just shut it down. And you know one thing they did in the process? I didn't realize this until yesterday when I saw a man with a service dog try to get into Arby's.
Oh, boy.
And there was a big line at the drive-thru, but he was trying to open the door.
Right.
And when he found out they were closed and he couldn't get in, he didn't get in line with the cars, right, with his service dog. He walked away, and what I suspect is that the guy doesn't have a car.
Right.
And he was looking for he may have been going to buy food at Arby's, but I suspect he was going to use the bathroom.
Mm.
And so what they have done by shutting down all the restaurants, where do you go if you're away from home
right.
and you need to go to the restroom?
Right, right.
Now, I usually try to buy something if I'm in a restaurant, but they're always cleaner
right.
than they are at a service station. But now you're going to take all the people and I mean, the only restrooms that are going to be available are some of them at service stations.
Well, the government would say that's good because that means you'll stay home. You won't go out, you know?
Yeah, right. And then, but what about the Amazon driver that's got to bring some essential item you need and you've been told to stay at home?
Right.
I had somebody on Twitter, an Amazon delivery person, say, you know, this is a real issue for me.
Right.
I had a truck driver tell me the same thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been to some countries where you see humans that don't have access to restrooms and they just defecate or urinate in the street.
Well, you mean San Francisco.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I the governor even went so far in Kentucky as to ban salons from opening, which when's the last time you saw 50 people in a salon? There's never 50 people in a salon, you know, and the new number is 10 people. But, you know, that's fine. I'll go to my place to get my hair cut and there's maybe 6-7 people in there tops, and they're spread out around the room. You know, I guess we'll have a lot of shaggy haired people at the end of this. I don't know.
Yeah. So, you know, long story short, I think they're not planning for the unintended consequences. If the trash piles up and then you have an explosion of rodents, population, they're going to carry other diseases.
Right.
There are people that are going to have a hard time taking care of their diabetic condition. I'm telling you, I think right now, the cure is worse than the disease.
I think, again, like I said, I'm supportive of a 2-week pause, but there needs to be a built-in, like, here's the plan after that. Like, to me, it would make sense to say, all right, for 2 weeks, everybody kind of stay as close to home as you can. Just chill out for a little bit. Not mandatory, but just please do. Take personal responsibility. Just go out and get what you need, and that's it. And then at the end of that 2 weeks, what we're going to do is we're going to ask politely for the elderly to stay in your homes until this whole thing blows over. And the people with immunocompromised situations, please stay in your home, and we'll arrange to, you know, people will volunteer, we'll arrange to bring stuff to you. But stay in your home and stay away from people. But the younger people that are healthy and will literally not be affected by this need to be able to go back to the business of keeping America open.
I agree. That's what we don't know yet. What's the tripwire for turning it back on?
Right.
So every governor that's turned the switch, that's turned off somebody's livelihood, they need to be able to tell us what's going to trigger them to turn it back on.
Right. I think what's interesting,
nobody said that yet.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is there's an assumption that all of those businesses have the capital to sit out who knows how long and then turn the switch back on, and then they can just go right back to work. Whereas there's no recognition that while their business is sitting still, they still have to pay the electric bill, the water bill. They're being told by the government they have to pay their workers without any labor being done, any profit being made, any product being sold. I mean, with the exception of what they can get in the drive-thru, but any business owner is going to tell you that that's not going to be enough for restaurants. So the thinking here, I understand the idea of saying, look, we got to pause for 2 weeks, but you've got to have an out. You have to have a long-term plan. And it doesn't look like anybody, all the way from the president down to the governors, has any inkling of what benchmarks for success would be.
No. And a vaccine that we're being told is 12 to 18 months away.
Right.
And anytime you go back to normal, I think we're going to go back on that curve, you know, absent some other changes.
Right.
And they'll say, oh, now we got to turn it off again.
Right.
And when you turn when you shut down a restaurant for 2 weeks or a month, they've got a whole inventory that's
rotting,
you know, unless it's frozen, and even some frozen stuff. But
right.
all their fresh food has to be thrown out or used some other way.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to have wasted food. It's just ridiculous. Even if they were going to shut it down, they should have shut it down in a more organized manner. But I don't think they should have shut it down.
Does it seem like to you the people that have the ear of our leaders right now are only the medical doctors and scientists, as opposed to, hey, guys, we got to think about this economically? Because the problem that I see arising from this is, you mentioned earlier, the cure is worse than the disease. And I think that's true. I think if we're not careful, if we go but much beyond a couple of weeks here, we're going to find that the ultimate devastation that comes from this economically is going to kill, and I mean dead, more people than this virus would have ever thought of killing. You're going to have people that are going to die of suicide because they're going to have financial ruin. You're going to have people that, even if they don't die, will never financially recover from this devastation. You're going to have people that are going to die because they're going to have be part of the newly uninsured, and they won't be able to take care of chronic illnesses, which will then lead to early deaths. So the death toll from the cure could be magnitudes of times bigger than the death toll from the disease itself.
Oh, that's absolutely right. And as far as who has the ear of our elected leaders, okay, I've been in the briefings, right? I'm a congressman. And so I can tell you that in the beginning, it was like the folks like Mnuchin that had the ear of the president and said, go out there, tell him everything's going to be fine. Don't worry about it. We got to keep the markets from panicking. We got to keep the stock market up, right?
Right.
And so the elected leaders in the beginning, they followed that advice and they lost their credibility. And then the medical guys come along and scare the crap out of them, and maybe rightfully so, but to get their attention. But now their reaction has no bearing on what's going to happen to the economy and the secondary effects, like you said, that could be and probably are worse than the virus.
Right.
So what's the fuse that they're going to blow? Well, they've decided to basically just print more money.
Right.
So the elected officials think, okay, I can listen to both of them.
Right.
I'll listen to the Wall Street and investment bankers who know about the economy.
Right.
And I'll listen to the medical folks. I'll just shut everything down and give away a lot of money.
Right.
And I had a reporter yesterday ask me, well, you know, we're looking at the economic indicators, and do you think the fundamentals of our economy are still in good shape? And I said, fundamentals? Let me tell you what the fundamental aspect of our economy is. The fundamental aspect is people wake up and they go to work and they make stuff.
Right.
And they said, no, the fundamentals are screwed up right now.
The fundamentals are turned off.
Yeah. So you can't, I say politicians need to think outside of the box, but they shouldn't be thinking outside of the constitutional box.
Right.
And they need to think more than one step ahead.
Right.
And they're not doing that right now.
Yeah, that's what
somebody would just fund the government, if they would come out and show me which epidemiological model they are using and what plan they are following and how long it's going to last and when they're going to turn it back on or under what conditions.
Right.
Then we could all get on the same page.
Right.
But I think what you have is like a cargo cult. You've got one governor do one thing, and then the other governor says, whoa, I better do that too.
Right.
And they're trying to one-up each other, and we're devolving into an unconstitutional government. We're abandoning the free market because it looks like the dictators have an advantage here in a pandemic because they can just shut everything down.
Right, and people will acquiesce because of fear.
Right, but the dictators end up starving a lot of people, and they just shoot the dissidents.
Yeah.
You know, like, we don't want to be in that situation, so don't give up on the free market.
Right.
The answer is fewer regulations. Imagine if you could buy a 12-pack of coronavirus tests.
Right.
And, you know, on Amazon. Buy it now, get 12 of these tests for $50. your employer would buy it for you if you would take one every day before you came to work.
Right.
And, you know, but the free market is the only place where you could achieve that. The
right.
government's not going to achieve that.
Well, we saw an example of the free market regulating itself early on in this when we had these two jack wagons from Tennessee that went around buying up all the hand sanitizer in rural Tennessee and rural southern Kentucky. And Amazon saw what they were doing. They were selling bottles of hand sanitizer that normally go for like 99 cents at the dollar store. They were selling for $80. Amazon steps in and goes, you can't do that on our platform. So then they end up with 80,000 bottles of hand sanitizer they can't get rid of. After that, the government stepped in. But before that, the capitalist market just sort of regulated itself. It was like, no, you can't sell hand sanitizers for $80 a bottle. You're not going to do that.
I mean, the anti-gouging laws are outdated if they ever really made sense. But they certainly don't now on the internet. Just go online. If there's one market where you can find every price within 5 seconds, it's the internet, right?
Right.
And having prices go up is an important aspect of capitalism that they don't teach in school. When the price of hand sanitizer goes up, that's a signal to the manufacturer to run that third shift.
Right.
Okay, you've got idle equipment.
Right.
And now that the price is higher, you can pay somebody time and a half overtime to come in and work longer hours. You can reach into a labor pool that was too expensive before, hire those people, get them to come in and make hand sanitizer. And then the market takes care of itself. It also does something else when the price goes up. It tells all those people that want to hoard it.
Don't do that
because you're going to be sitting on a bunch of hand sanitizer that you paid four times as much for as you should have.
Right.
And you're going to feel stupid here in about a month when the factories catch up.
Right. Right. Yeah. So, the same with toilet paper right now. You know, it's just like the factories are going to catch up with this here in just a little bit. Georgia Pacific's facility down in Georgia has started running 24 hours a day. You know, they're going to catch up. There's going to be toilet paper back on the shelves. And there's going to be a lot of people sitting around who hoarded toilet paper going, what do I need all this for the next year and a half? And I paid full price for it, too, dadgummit.
Right. So, and people will be trying to return that stuff at some point.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it does, the price going up does one other thing that I think is important. It's a signal to people to take the items and buy them where they're not needed. Carry them at some expense to where they are needed and sell them there.
Right. It's a good point.
And I mean, yeah, maybe the guys in Tennessee are jack wagons.
Well, they are because they were selling it for $80 and nobody could get it. Elderly people in southern Kentucky couldn't get hand sanitizer because they took all of it off the shelf. But
yeah,
I don't believe that.
I don't believe that. I think, you know, my Dollar General store, as soon as you buy them out, the truck shows up the next day, and there it is again.
Wasn't happening here. I mean, we're going to have to agree to disagree on this. I mean, I think what did happen was that capitalism regulated itself in that these guys had only one platform to multiply that price. And that platform said, you can't do it because we're a private platform. We're not going to let you do that. You know, the situation corrected itself when the private sector said, no. Nobody's going to buy these for $80. You're stuck with 80,000 bottles of sanitizer. And, you know, they got their comeuppance. They got stuck. They lost their money. So that's fair.
And they could have sold it somewhere else, but the problem is the government stepped in and confiscated all their stuff.
they could have sold it on the street, I guess.
And now they're going to be – no. Well, now the government's taken it.
Now they have,
and,
right.
Yeah.
They could have sold it on the street. Yeah.
And – so I think the government should have stayed out of the way. At least we can agree on that.
Well, and you're right about all the signaling. I mean, you give a great lesson on capitalism. When prices inch up, it's a signal, like you said. And that allows for the greater production. My concern here, too, and we'll get into farm freedom in a second because we've kind of drifted, but I think this is a good discussion to have. But my concern about the supply chain right now is that if we're telling everybody to stay home and we're shutting doors on businesses – you know, how do we keep people employed that are supplying the things we supposedly need when none of the other, I mean, our economy is consumer based for the most part. We don't really make a lot of things. So when you shut down the whole consumer aspect of the economy, how do you restart that engine?
And who decides what's an essential company?
Mm-hmm.
Because now you're in central planning.
Right.
That almost never works out.
Right.
Like you could say, okay, the garbage delivery guy, he's essential. He's got to get up and go to work. But what about the machine shop that fixes the garbage truck when it breaks? And I guarantee you those things break all the time.
Oh, yeah.
What about the place that changes the oil?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, you know, it's not essential to do preventative maintenance, right?
Right.
But now what happens when they, you know, when they had a oil change schedule and they skipped it, and now the thing runs out of oil because they don't regularly check the oil because, you know, they're used to the service doing that.
Right.
And I mean, you can't imagine what's essential. You just can't do it. And you could almost argue that the public schools were essential.
Yeah.
Because if the garbage truck driver has to stay home to take care of his kid because the kid can't go to school and the governor shut down the daycares, you know, now what are you going to do?
Well,
go in and put a gun to the garbage truck driver's head?
There was an interesting side note to this. Joe Rogan had a guy on his podcast that's one of the most respected, scientists in the area of studying viruses.
And I watched part of that.
Yeah. And the part where he said he actually recommended not closing the schools. And he, for the very reason he said, kids aren't really affected by this. They can spread it, and that's bad. But in terms of them just playing together on the playground and being in classrooms, they're not going to be affected by this. What is going to be affected is the fact that 40% of America's nursing staff have kids in school. And if we take all of those kids out of school and they now don't have childcare, you've just crippled our healthcare system at the time when we need all hands on deck. I thought that was an interesting take.
Here's my take on this, what they should have done at the school. You know, they'll arrest you if you don't send your kid to school. Like if your kid misses too much school.
Right.
I got one of those letters once. Like they were threatening to bring charges against me because the school, there was an outbreak of what's the virus that can get into your spine?
Oh, meningitis.
Meningitis, yeah. So there was a known outbreak of meningitis at our school, and my wife was 8 months pregnant with our fourth child, and I decided, you know what? My wife can't take the medication if she gets this.
Mm-hmm.
We're just going to keep our kids. This was between, like, we were between Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Right.
Okay. And I'm like, we're just keeping the kids home. There's only, you know, like 12 days of instruction anyway. So I tried it, and I got these letters that said I was going to get arrested. Okay. That's the stupidity of government, right?
Right.
I was ready to act on my own to take precautions for a vulnerable person
right.
from a disease. Okay. What the school system should have done is they should have changed their stupid law that says if you don't have 80% attendance, your school district doesn't get your money.
Right.
And they should have said school is optional.
Yes.
Okay. Now, what would have happened is the 30% of the parents who rely on school either for daycare or to feed their kids would have kept sending their kids to school. And the 70% who could make other arrangements would have kept their kids home. And if you decrease the number of people there by 70%, probably the likelihood they're going to spread something goes down as the square of that, right?
Right, yeah.
So it would be, it would have had nearly the same effect, and it wouldn't have caused all these ripple
effects. Well, it's interesting in your discussion there is essentially the model the government's using on this shutdown, except they're doing it by force, as opposed to trusting that if you know, people have enough information about this disease, most people are going to stick to the house for the most part on their own accord. You know, I was already making adjustments. The only place I was going was the gym, and then I was working from home, and I would go out and get groceries when necessary, and I'd already decided I would only eat out once a week or whatever. I wouldn't take that risk more often. Most people would do that, and you would exponentially slow the spread of this disease. I don't think you have to pull the plug on the economy.
Let me tell you the precautions I was taking. Okay. When I went to eat at a restaurant, I would only order hot food. And you'll like this one. I would only drink alcohol. And I dipped my fork in the alcohol before
there
I ate
go.
My food.
Done.
Okay. I basically pretended I was in India or China. Okay?
Okay.
You don't eat the fresh fruit and the salad there.
Right.
Okay. Or drink the tap water.
Right.
So I basically went on that sort of regimen if you go to a restaurant. In my office, we had a handshake free zone. We
right.
put up signs. This is a handshake free zone.
Right.
Okay. We did that. I have an aunt that I stay with when I'm in D.C. I'm not going to violate any HIPAA stuff, but let's consider her part of the vulnerable population.
Right.
I rented an RV and parked it in her driveway the last week of Congress, right?
Yeah.
Like on, what's the Christmas Vacation?
Yes.
I was like the guy out there
Cousin
in
Eddie.
The driveway.
Cousin Eddie. Surprise, surprise.
surprise, Aunt. So I pulled in an RV.
You serious,
she
Clark?
She tried to get me to come in the house, and I'm like, no, I'll just stay out here. Just show me where to drop the gray water. No.
Crapper's full.
Anyways, and we took meetings by telephone or teleconference, you know, the people
yeah.
that wanted to meet me in my office that week, because I have dozens of meetings every week. This was after, you know, as it progressed and people took it more seriously, we just took all our meetings by phone.
Right.
And those were, and I drove instead of flying. And those were the precautions that I took.
Yeah. And it's, there's the smart precautions, and they probably protected you. And the other side of this is that literally the vast majority of people who have COVID-19 don't even know it. Never experienced negative implications from it, and go on about their lives, and they get better, and they've gotten better already. And, you know, the headline where you hear that is like, oh, this is bad. And I'm like, no, that's good. The vast majority of people will not be harmed by this virus. It's relatively mild for the vast majority of people. We do need to take precautions to protect the vulnerable. But other than that, people should live their lives and just take some basic precautions.
To your point, we need a different kind of test that tests whether you have the antibodies in your system. In other words, were you exposed to it once and now you've recovered,
right.
and you won't be catching it again, and you aren't shedding the virus, right? That's the kind of test we need to know that when we can turn things back on.
Yes, yes.
And I think if you go get treatment from a hospital and you're one of the thousands, you know, they claim who have recovered, you should get something like a birth certificate, like a government issued ID, right? Okay, I am post COVID. Right.
Post COVID, I like
and post COVID, I can take care of the elderly, I can go to work, I can prepare food for other people.
Right.
I am one of the chosen who were exposed and recovered. Here's the irony, and we should be tracking that, right? We should be tracking that. The irony is, and I hate this for Italy. I know they had to make some tough decisions, and their healthcare was overwhelmed. Wouldn't it be, and they're considered the biggest failure in the world right now, wouldn't it be interesting if 2 or 3 months from now, our economy is worse than Italy's?
Right.
And Italy has herd immunity. And they are back to work, and they become a manufacturing powerhouse because
right.
the economic fundamentals, in other words, people get up and go to work,
right.
aren't screwed up in Italy, but they're still screwed up here. Wouldn't that be ironic?
Yeah. Well, there's also statistics about Italy that the media is not reporting when they're using it to scare us into submission, and that is that Italy's population is one of the oldest in the world. And it's one of the most smoking populations in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, and then the third thing is that they have a tradition there of multiple generations living in the same household. So when they are forcing people who are young and healthy, but maybe are carriers of it, to be jammed into a house with grandma, grandma gets the disease and grandma has to go to the hospital. So there's a litany of things that are different culturally and aspects of how that country lives their lives that are the reason why there's such a high rate of death there. Now, America has its own problems. We have a high rate of obesity and complications that could lead to many people having problems with it as well. But we're also a lot more spread out, and we don't have that tradition of 4 or 5 generations living in the same household.
By the way, have you seen the ages of my cohorts in Congress and the comorbidities that they possess?
Right.
Like, that's probably part of the overreaction is that they are feeling
vulnerable.
Their mortality. Yeah.
Yeah, they're vulnerable to it. Well, let's talk about how this plays into the real point of the discussion we were going to have today, and that's farm freedom.
Yeah, you promised me we'd talk about food freedom.
Well, and I just I think it is such an important issue. You and I have talked about it many, many times. Labeling, knowing where your food comes from. If you have a cow and you milk that cow, and I want to buy fresh milk straight from a cow, I should be able to call you up and make that purchase. Understanding there could be, you know, there could be things with that it's not been pasteurized or whatever, but I'm willing to take that risk. And what's ironic about that is that my grandparents had a farm and my mom grew up drinking the cream right off the top, skimming that cream right off the top of the bucket after milking the cows, and it never made her sick. So, you know, I mean, we should have the freedom to do that. And putting that locally is one way to keep our food chain a little bit safer and let people get access to stuff in times of shortage.
Yeah, that's the safest food supply system is a local food supply system. But the rules and regulations are set up such that it's almost impossible now for a farmer to sell food directly to a consumer if it's something like meat or milk. And what that's done is it's pushed all the business into an aggregation of four big meat packers, four dairy companies, and basically food, milk and beef and pork from thousands of animals is commingled at these factories and then redistributed to consumers. Under the imprimatur of the USDA that it's safe, but all the recalls you see come from these big industrialized food suppliers. I'm not sure exactly what happens to it, but I can tell you, if you buy it locally, there's accountability.
Right.
And what I've come up against in Congress, and this is part of the swamp, is every time I try to make the regulations appropriate for the scale of the enterprise, in other words, I try to reduce the regulations on the small farmer, the small meat packer, the small dairies. The big guys come in with their money and their lobbyists and try to shut it down. Even the organizations that are supposed to support farmers oppose my legislation that would help farmers because they're in cahoots with the big companies. And that's a problem. So let me give you an example. I introduced a bill to allow you to sell raw milk across state lines. If it's legal in state A and it's legal in state B, why can't you sell? Because each of the states get to decide, you know, what they're, and that's as it should be. But right now, the government will come and arrest you if you do a transaction across state lines, even if it's legal in the two states between which the transaction is occurring. So I introduced a bill and said, all right, we're not going to arrest you if you're selling it and buying it between two states where it's legal to have that transaction.
Right.
Within 24 hours, the dairy lobby came after me, and in all their trade journals and in any publication that would have them, they got pieces placed that said that I'd be responsible for the death of, you know, tens of thousands of people, that kids were going to die, kidneys were going to fail, and, you know, the blood would be on my hands. And my wife's Google alerts are going off. She's seeing all this in the media. I didn't even tell her I was going to introduce the bill that day, that week. And she texts me and she said, have you seen this, these reports? And I said, yeah, I saw them. She texted back, OMG, I didn't realize the lactose lobby was so intolerant. And she hit the nail on the head. They don't want any deviation because right now they've got the farmers in a bind. They got them over barrel because the farmers have only one place to sell it. They have to sell it to the big dairies, the big conglomerates, the co-ops, and they have to take what they get. And as long as the big co-ops can keep the farmers in this model where they're selling a commodity and it's just based on milk fat, percentage weight milk fat, then they've got the farmers in a bind and they can work one farmer against the other. And it's just not worked out well. And also, you know, our government tries to come up with ways to protect our farmers from Canadian farmers, for instance, right? The whole milk wars. Well, you wouldn't need to do that if you let people sell fresh milk, because fresh milk has to be delivered locally. It's hard to do international commerce in fresh milk.
Right.
So if they would let the dairy sell fresh milk instead of pasteurized milk, they would be at an advantage domestically.
Right. Yeah.
And I think the big conglomerates know that. They want to be able to treat it as a commodity worldwide and sell it as like dried milk.
Right. That doesn't make any sense, though. I mean, the fresher the product, the healthier the product, not the other way around.
Oh, but here's how they regulate it. You'll like this. Congress never passed a law to outlaw raw milk or the interstate transport thereof. It was in the 1980s that these consumer advocacy groups, it may have been Ralph Nader, were trying to get the FDA to regulate raw milk, and they said, no, we don't have the authority, and by the way, there's just not enough cases of people getting sick from it for it to be worth our time. Well, they got sued in court. They lost the court case, the FDA did. And so as a concession, they just started regulating raw milk, but the law that they used, the authority they claimed, was their authority to regulate adulterated milk, to ban adulterated milk. Because Congress said, okay, FDA, you're in charge of making sure adulterated milk.
What's adulterated milk? Is it milk that's not faithful to the cow?
That's a good one. Adulterated would be if you added chemicals or you added some foreign substance to it.
Right.
Anyways, they claimed that fresh milk was adulterated milk.
Why?
And that... And they don't regulate. They just ban it. It's not like, oh, you can sell it as long as you're these certain things we test for are under a certain level, or if you have these certain precautions. No, they just outright banned it.
So you have to have milk that has gone through a chemical process, not necessarily had chemicals added to it, but a chemical process, and then had
it's changed chemically.
Changed chemically.
That's
the only way you can have milk. But they claim that fresh milk, which has had nothing done to it, is adulterated.
Right. Exactly.
When in fact, most of the milk you buy and drink is adulterated, period.
Something's been done to it.
Right.
For sure.
More close to the definition of adulterated.
the chemical composition of it has changed. You can't heat something up without changing it.
So anyways,
that's the whole swamp. That's how the swamp came to regulate milk. That's what the swamp does when I try to create an economic opportunity for small farmers to sell to consumers, two willing parties trying to have a transaction to trade in something that's been with our civilization for at least, probably 10,000 years.
Don't you fight a battle that's almost unwinnable from the standpoint of, now that the industrial farms have weeded out the small farmer, what I think the small farmer is, 2% of farming in America. So you don't have a constituency big enough, because the vast majority of people are like, oh, that sounds nice, but I go to the store and I buy a gallon of milk and it's just the regular stuff. There's not a lot of pent up demand from the average American to go to a local farm, which there was, but to go to a local farm and purchase a gallon of fresh milk straight from the cow. Doesn't that make this battle that much harder, in the sense that the industrial farms have already won? They've, like you said, they've got the farmers over a barrel. If the farmers agree to go to work for them, they loan them the money for the seeds and all this stuff, and then the financing becomes a trap, and then they're stuck in that system, and they have to do it the way they say to do it, and they have to use their seeds and all that stuff. And at the end of the day, you're left with 2% of the world that can farm the way you farm on your land, and there's just not enough people that are upset enough about this to make a difference.
Well, here's how we break the logjam. There are always going to be gray markets, maybe even black markets. People, when they want something, they get a hold of it, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like in Florida, as long as you label raw milk as pet food, you can sell it to somebody.
Pet food.
So, In every state, there's certain ways around it.
Okay.
If you own the cow, most states won't arrest you for drinking the milk from the cow if you own the cow.
Right.
So why can't 10 people own a cow, right?
So you do a co-op. Then,
yeah, share it. It's a herd share.
It's community cow.
It, whatever.
Yeah.
And so through the gray markets or the margins of the laws, people are able to get a taste of what their grandparents had, like real food.
And once you do.
And some people, once you do, you know, they're addicted.
Yeah.
And so there's, because otherwise you're a chicken and the egg, right? Because if the industrial farms and co-ops have shut down the ability to get these kind of foods and nobody's ever tasted these foods, then you're right. There's no constituency for them.
Yeah.
But the great thing about this country is people, they want to live free and they find a way. There's a lot of ingenuity. We just recently had a symposium in Northern Kentucky. We had about 300 people show up. It was called the Rogue Food Conference. Rogue. And the whole symposium was about how to get around the laws, not how to comply with them, but how to avoid them. And because you have this, you know, this contingency of people who just won't give up, people are still getting to experience real food, and there's nothing like it in the world. And so that's what keeps this movement alive.
You know, it's interesting. I've got two hunts scheduled out in Colorado this fall, and I'm taking my nephew with me. He's a good hunter. And he's just going to go and be like a spotter and range finder out there. You have to track the deer. You can't sit in a tree all day and wait for them to come to you on a farm. If I get something, I told him, I said, we'll split it. And he, you know, that's not illegal. But if you take a cow on your farm, you cut it up and you want to sell me half of it, unless I'm part of that co-op of the cow, you can't do that. Because you didn't go through the industrial process where that cow went, got split up, parted together with other cows, and then came back to me at the local grocery store. I could have bought it direct from you on your farm where I saw that cow. And if I'm your neighbor, I watched that cow grow up. I know which cow it is. And I could have that fresh, healthy, direct meat straight from that wonderful limestone-fed grass on your farm. Yeah. Or I could go to the grocery store and pick up a cow that might have come from who knows where, New Jersey.
Yeah, or you're buying hamburgers, so you're buying multiple cows.
It could be, yeah, a cow from six different states.
1 pound at a time. So, again, and I'm glad we're talking about meat now because there's a lot bigger constituency for steak than there is for raw milk.
Right.
Okay. And there are some connoisseurs of steak. I'm one of them. And I'm a purveyor and a connoisseur of steak and all kinds of beef. There are loopholes that we use here that demonstrate the reliability of the meat that we're selling.
Right.
So I can sell my neighbor steak, but he's got to buy into the live animal before he receives the food, and he can't just buy steak. He's got to buy like half or a quarter. A quarter is the smallest portion of an animal I can sell my neighbor without going to one of these special facilities.
Okay.
But I have to sell it to my neighbor by the live weight. In other words, he doesn't know how much meat he's going to get because the loophole we're using here is that he owns part of the animal. He has stock in the animal.
While the animal's still grazing on your farm, he owns a piece of
it. Right. So I have to sell it to him on the hoof, so to speak.
Right.
And then I take it to the processor. I am technically not allowed to pick up his meat from the processor and take it to him. At this point, he's supposed to go to the processor and pick it up. Now, virtually everybody who's using this loophole I know violates this. And I don't know too many people have been arrested for it, but here's where you go to jail. Here's where you go to jail, Leland. If you came to me and say, I've seen that steer, I like how you raised it, I watched it grow up, I need 5 T-bones for my barbecue this weekend.
From that steer, right?
From that steer. And I got to say, Leland, I go to jail if I sell you 5 steaks because you have to buy half the animal. By the way, you're going to get the tail and the tongue and the liver and the heart. Like, you're going to get half of all of that, whether you like it or not.
Right.
Because I have to sell you half the animal. I can't sell you a steak or we go to jail. Unless I put that steer in a trailer and drive 3 hours to the nearest appropriate facility that's approved for selling meat by the package. Now, they have a full-time USDA employee there. Well, but, you know, I have a meat processor that's 3 miles from my house, Leland. 3 miles. But I have to drive by him and go 3 hours to a facility that's approved by the government if I want to sell you a steak.
Wow.
It's a ridiculous impediment. And the big meat packers like it that way.
Right.
By the way, of all the people who've bought half a steer or a quarter of a steer using the loophole, I don't know a single person on this planet who's gotten sick from that. Okay?
They're probably less likely to get sick than they would from the grocery store wrapped in cellophane sitting there for who knows how long.
Much less likely. In fact, I've never heard of it happening because you can also go to the processor.
Right.
Like, you can walk down or drive down, it's 3 miles away, to the processor and look in the back and see his whole process. There's no mystery from the farm to your table.
Right.
So here's the bill that I introduced. It's called the Prime Act. Everything's an acronym in D.C., so we came up with this acronym.
I like it. Prime Beef.
Processor Revival. In other words, these local processors are going to be able to do more business. Processor Revival, Intrastate Meat Exemption.
I like it.
So what I wanted to do was to take this loophole and make it big enough that you could actually do real commerce with your neighbors.
Right.
And I thought about saying, well, what if we limit it by size? Because I want it to be size appropriate. You know, let's say, okay, if you sell less than 50 animals a year, then you can use this exemption.
Right.
But I thought, no, that's what they did with Obamacare. If you, the small business exception keeps businesses small.
Right.
Once you get to 50 animals, right, the cost of compliance going to 51 keeps you from never going to 51.
Right.
And the same thing with employees if you're under Obamacare, yada, yada, yada. So instead, what I said was, instead of using a numerical boundary, let's use the state boundary. And this gets to the constitutionality of my bill. Nobody can argue about the constitutionality of it. What my bill says is, as long as the consumer and the farmer and the processor are all within the same state, then the federal government can't stop that transaction. As long as the consumer, the farmer, and the processor are complying with state law, then they can exchange beef or pork or lamb in any quantity they want. And it seems like a pretty simple concept.
Right.
And I think I've got 2 dozen co-sponsors, and I've got a Senate version of it as well that has 3 senators on it right now. But the lead sponsor of this bill, of the Prime Act, in the Senate, is none other than Angus King.
Who caucuses with the Democrats, but that name, Angus Prime.
The name, yeah. It was like Rand Paul said, oh, I'll sponsor it. I understand. This is freedom. This is better food.
Right.
I said, Rand, can you just play second fiddle on this one? I've got a certain senator in mind that needs to sponsor.
It's got
to
be Angus.
Sponsor.
I love it.
It sounds like a promotion, a beef promotion, the Angus King, right?
That's awesome.
Or a ranch, right?
Right.
Angus King Ranch.
Right.
Anyways, so he's the sponsor in the Senate. Lamar Alexander is the third sponsor, in addition to Rand Paul. And every single beef farmer, every single consumer, every single processor, including the USDA processor that's 3 hours from my house, is in favor of this bill.
Wow.
Because the USDA guy who's 3 hours from my house, by the way, how green is it? It's
right.
Not green at all. To drive animals 3 hours away, it's also less humane
right.
to put them in a trailer for 3 hours.
Yep, get them all stressed out. Yep.
Yeah, then you got to go back. You got to go back and get them and drive the meat 3 hours. It's the furthest from green and sustainable that you can imagine.
Right.
But even that processor down there, I called them up because I need to get some beef processed. I called them up in like December, and I said, when's the next appointment that you can fit me in for two steers? I need two steers butchered. And they looked and they're like, it's like April. I'm
wow.
like, 5 months away?
Right.
This is like the Soviet Union,
right?
Right.
Right.
You know, my friend Rand Paul tells a joke. A guy went to buy a car in the Soviet Union, and the dealer says, okay, you can come and this was in December. He says, you can pick it up in July. He said, July? That's crazy. He says, you want the car or not? He said, okay, yeah. He says, what day in July? And he says, well, you know, July 10th. He says, okay, what time is it today? And the car dealer looks at him. He says, are you ridiculous? I just told you it's 6 months from now. Why do you want to know what time of the day? He says, because I got the plumber coming that day. The painful thing about that joke is that's how long it takes
right.
to get a steak from your neighbor to go through the government-approved facility.
Right.
And by the way, my local processor that's 3 miles from my house, he's inspected by the health department, and he's subject to surprise inspections by the USDA,
right.
both of which he's fine with.
Right.
He doesn't want to hide anything.
Right.
He just can't afford to pay a government employee to be there every day, which is the requirement if you want to sell meat by the cut.
But he could have had those two steers chopped up for you by the end of the week.
Oh, yeah. He's actually already chopped up one. Like, we just kind of, you know, if somebody wants it now, the buy it now option, he's got like a 2 week wait. Okay. He's like,
right.
all right, I'll fit you in 2 weeks.
Right. Right.
And, but the person I sold that one to bought the whole animal.
Right.
And that's the only reason we could use him.
Is the crux... go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, here's another thing, and this is why I've been able to get Democrats on board with this bill, is they recognize if you require a family to buy half a cow in order to buy healthy meat...
Right.
That is so regressive.
Right.
Because they've got to buy a freezer, they've got to plug it in, they've got to spend money on electricity, they've got to have a space for that freezer.
Right.
And basically what you're saying to low and actually low middle income consumers is you can't buy this beef.
Right.
You can't afford it because there's so much involved. And that's really shameful because it should be more affordable than the animals that are shipped from Kentucky to Nebraska and fed corn and then butchered out there somewhere and then shipped back to Kroger's here. It should be more affordable to grow it here and butcher it here, but
and
it's
you're
not.
You're not talking about making the kind of Wild West wet meat market like China has that may have been the source of this virus, because some people will push back and say, you're talking about anarchy. No, you're talking about facilities that have all been inspected, that are all subject
right.
to inspections. You're not talking about changing a thing in how the quality control and safety control of the animal is handled from the point of your farm to the point it gets to the consumer. All you're talking about is making it available. That's it.
That's right. They've all been inspected, and better yet, you can go inspect it yourself.
Right. The only difference is there's not some full-time bureaucrat sitting in an office doing nothing all day at the guy down the street from you versus the guy 3 hours from you.
That's right. And by the way, they usually send bureaucrats from at least an hour away,
right?
Because a lot of them aren't the. I'm not going to pick on bureaucrats. They're just playing by the rules.
Yeah, yeah, I hear
they're
you.
Just playing by the rules.
So, is the crux of why this is even a problem really centered around the fact that big business is in the pocket of the vast majority of politicians, aka the swamp? And when you
vice
come,
vice versa, yeah,
yeah,
or vice versa,
right? And
Trump is in the pocket of big business, yeah,
right. Well, yeah, that's what I mean. I guess that's what I mean. But I mean, that's the reason why common sense bills like this, you know, never get passed. Whereas the average person gets this gets explained to the average person, they shake their head. I can't believe that that is allowed to go on, and yet it does because of the swamp, because of how tied in that big money is to most of the congressmen.
You know, every farmer in my congressional district I've talked to is in favor of my bill. And when you get to D.C., the National Cattlemen's Association, which most of them are associated with through a membership in their Kentucky Cattlemen's Association, the National Cattlemen's Association opposes my bill. Because the reality is they're in the pocket. They're basically lobbyists for the meat packers.
Right.
But nobody wants to call their lobby the meat packers lobby, right? So they call it the cattleman's lobby.
Right.
And then they get cattlemen to join it. And these organizations do good stuff at the local level.
Right.
At the state level, they're conflicted. And by the time you get to the swamp, they're working against the members.
Right.
So it's not just the politicians that have sold out. And there are other organizations I could name on here, but... man, I got so many people mad at me. The National Cattlemen's Association, by the way, when I got to Congress, they were so excited to have a farmer who actually handles his own cattle, feeds his own cattle, knows about all the ins and outs of raising cattle. They were so excited, they said they'd do a fundraiser for me. And I said, okay. I said, what do you want out of the farm bill? They said, we don't want anything out of a farm bill. We want to be left out of the farm bill. And I thought, well, this is great. So they were going to host a fundraiser for me at their place. And I voted against the farm bill, and they called up within 30 minutes and canceled the fundraiser.
Why would they do that?
Because they wanted the farm bill.
They just didn't want to be associated with it.
Right, exactly. Because the meat,
they didn't clarify to you that they wanted you to vote no. They just said they don't want to be a part of it.
Right. Here's follow the money. Let me walk it back for you. To sell cheap beef in the stores, you need cheap grain. And the grain farmers, through a euphemism called insurance, are subsidized.
Okay.
And so the meat packers do want cheap grain.
Right.
And so that's why
the farm subsidy bill provides the cheap grain, but they don't want to be associated with it because they don't want to be attached to something that looks like they're asking for subsidies. And you made the mistake of not understanding the lay of the land and following the swamp rules. You know, and so they rejected you after they found out you actually thought through all of it. That's fascinating.
And this is how the swamp works. They cancel your fundraisers.
Yeah.
They try to cut you off.
Yeah. Well, thank goodness you come from a district that's got enough common sense people that understand what you're doing, that you don't have to have all that money. I know you'd like to have the fundraising, but I mean that if you can get by without it because enough people know what you're up to, you know.
I might have said this on a podcast previously. You know, I don't want to act like I'm pure as the wind-driven snow here and above money. I would take their money if they would give it to me. They just won't give it to me.
Well, but you won't vote as necessarily told. So it's like, yeah, you'll take the check. You're just not going to be owned.
That's right. And I tell people, I do appreciate people that donate to me. I really do, because I need it to get reelected. But donate to me if you think I'm pulling in your direction, not if you're trying to get me to pull in another direction that doesn't benefit my constituents.
Right. As we wrap this up, first of all, two questions. One, what do you want to do on the next episode of The Swamp Monster? What topic should we cover? I'd like to cover privacy and why every time something gets discussed about personal privacy, by the time it gets to a piece of legislation, it's the reverse of that.
Yeah, that would be great, because either today or tomorrow, they're going to try and voice vote a 77-day reauthorization of the Patriot Act in the House of Representatives while we're all home.
Of course.
Trying to deal with COVID-19.
Avoid COVID-19, they'll voice vote it. Perfect. We'll do that on the next one. As to COVID-19, sort of the last thing, are we going to make it through this, or is this going to drastically change America as we know it?
It's going to drastically change things. I mean, we will make it through it. I'm worried that a whole generation is going to be trained to just ask how high when the government says to jump.
Right.
And using fear, the government is going to get us to do unnatural things, and the government is going to justify unconstitutional activity using our fear of our own mortality. And I'm worried. I mean, our economy can recover.
Right.
I just don't know if the American psyche, if our fundamental belief in freedom is going to recover. We need to cling to the free market system. It can save us. Instead, I see elected officials abandoning the free market system.
Right.
And that's my biggest concern.
Yeah, I feel like I feel like this is the greatest evidence any government future needs to know that all they have to do is find something sufficiently scary and they can get us to do whatever they want.
Absolutely. And by the way, they've postponed my election.
Yeah. June 23rd, I think.
Yeah, to June 23rd. It was going to be May 19th. I would ask the people who are doing this, show me your epidemiological model. Like, what model are you using that right. says things are going to be better on June 23rd than they are May 19th?
Right.
Or are you just going on a hunch?
Right. And where in between might we be able to pull the trigger to start the engine again?
Right.
Yeah.
How many times are they going to postpone the election?
Right. That's another thing that I think scares people is, like, on one hand, the government comes out and says, we're going to do this for 2 weeks. But then some states are saying 30 days. The postponements go well into June. I mean, how long are we going to be shut up in our homes?
Oh, it's going to go beyond 2 weeks. And as much as I admire your willingness to talk about the Patriot Act and the FISA stuff on our next podcast, I got to believe the next time we talk, we're still going to be talking about
this
coronavirus somehow.
Yeah,
but
probably.
We can't let this weapon of mass distraction
right.
get in the way of everything else. And it's a distraction. It's a valid distraction. I don't mean to downplay it. It's a serious virus.
Right, sure.
But we just can't. You know, we got to think out of the box, but we got to stay in that constitutional box.
Yeah. Yeah. Right on. Congressman Thomas Massie, it's always a pleasure. This has been the third part. We have a lot more to talk about with the swamp. We'll do the privacy one next time. Thanks for the update on COVID-19 as well. We appreciate your time, and let's hope we get some farm freedom sometime soon.
All right. Sounds good.
All right.
You know, they're abandoning enforcing all the other laws. Why don't we abandon arresting farmers for raw milk? At least during this time of crisis.
Yeah, yeah. At least give us fresh milk right now. I love it. Congressman Thomas Massie, thanks for joining us on the Disruption Zone.
Thank you, Leland.
All right, really great stuff. Wow. You know, every one of these episodes is just phenomenal when we get into the swamp and what is going on in Washington, D.C. And I echo what he said there. I do take this virus seriously in the sense that I want to save as many lives as possible, but I think we need to start thinking, what is the exit strategy here? Because if we shut down the economy for any much longer than 2 weeks, I'm telling you right now, the devastation that is going to be reaped from that is going to kill far more people than this virus ever imagined that it could. So I'll leave you with that. All right, you can follow us on Instagram. It's at GreatlyLondo and at The Disruption Zone. We're on Twitter. It's at Zone Disruption and at Leland Show. The best thing you can do for me and this podcast is to share it with your friends. You can download it on Apple Podcasts. You can also get it on Spreaker. We're also available on Google Play, pretty much wherever podcasts are found. So subscribe today. It's free. And download and share it with your friends. Send a link to your friends. Let's get everybody listening to this as much as possible and amplify that voice. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our co-executive producer and co-host Cameron Mills, and to for their production help to Dynamics Audio.
Productions in Lexington, Kentucky. Whether or not you're just refurbing old VHS tapes and updating them to a digital format so you can watch your old family memories, or you're producing a Hollywood production, they've got you covered either way at dxaudio.com for more. Again, thanks for listening to The Disruption Zone. I am Leland Conway.